Hey, Whiskey Fridays listeners, it's Tara McMullen again, back with part two of my conversation with Kate, your usual host, and Charlie Gilkey. This part of the conversation examines the promise of the creator economy, how that impacts our relationships with other creators, and how healthy skepticism could go a long way to building more solidarity among creative workers. Enjoy! The promise of the creator economy is a life well lived doing what you love. Fulfillment, autonomy, flexibility, self-expression, community, a stable, comfortable, middle-class life. Writing in The New Yorker, Kyle Chayka put it this way: the model promises a more human and less automated interaction. But, he says, this emerging field resembles a gig economy for digital content. Participants are still precarious workers relying on the whims of corporations for their livelihoods. The creator economy, to my mind, represents a sort of overflow room for a certain brand of surplus labor, what I've called a surplus elite. I've been part of this surplus labor pool since 2009. That's pre-Instagram and before YouTube even started calling their users creators. I've watched what we now call the creator economy grow, evolve, and mature for 15 years. By and large, the people who are shuttled into this overflow room are those of us who punched our ticket to the middle class with a college education and colorful extracurricular interests. Maybe we entered the professional world and embarked on a chosen career. Maybe we lost our way and ended up in one of the other overflow rooms, like Starbucks or Barnes & Noble. Maybe we were doing just fine before the economic crash in 2008, the 2016 election, or whatever the hell 2020 was. For one reason or another, the traditional middle-class job market didn't want us or couldn't satisfy us. It didn't meet our needs. And we ended up here, together, in the surplus labor pool doing what surplus labor does. Fending for ourselves. Now look, that sounds bleak. I know it does. And there are many parts of this world, online and offline, that are bleak, that give me little reason for hope. But that's not what this episode is about. Philosopher Rahel Yeghi argues that our experience of alienation is bound up with the question of how we want to live. Alienation, she says, occurs when we don't even think to ask that question any longer. The promise of the creator economy stopped many of us from asking that question. We took for granted that the vision expressed by venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, and marketing machines was our vision, too. We took on that vision as an attempt at de-alienating ourselves and our labor. But today, there are murmurs, whispers, and even some shouts. Perhaps we've ended up right back where we started, in the overflow room. We are asking, how do I want to live? And realizing that it's not like this. I'm Tara McMullen, and this is What Works, the show that rethinks work, business, and leadership for the 21st century economy. In this episode, the second half of my conversation with Charlie Gilkey and Kate Tyson about the creator economy, we're asking better questions. Yes, how do we want to live? And also, how do we want to create? What do we want from this type of production? What do we expect from the technology we use? And perhaps most importantly, what can we build together and how can we organize? But first, let's start with a different question. What are we willing to do to be heard?
This is a weird tangent, but we're weird tangent folks, so we can go there.
We know there are many hoops to jump through if we want to be heard. To put our ideas or creative expression in the hands of an algorithm is to play by rules software engineers encoded it with. Everyone has a different tolerance for how they'll shape a message in order to fit into the space created on a platform. Now, this isn't a new problem.
Reminds me back in the days when Obama was president and he had to do the media tour for the Affordable Care Act. And so he ended up on all these random comedy shows that millennials watched and that young folks watched because it was important enough to him to show up to do that sort of thing. If the president of the United States can end up on this random comedy show that's not for him, but just to do this sort of thing, so there are some pieces of work that's important enough to play the game.
Obama, his speechwriters, and his press team were savvy and, I think, more than a little playful. Their tolerance level for the late aughts media scene seemed grounded in both fervent belief in the message and genuine interest in mass culture. And that's a great combination to have if you're in the creator economy.
There are some pieces of work that's important enough to play the game and to get it out in that shape and form, because it's more important for me to have that reach and impact than it is for me to state it the way that philosopher Charlie might say it. And I think that's a trade-off we have to have, but it still goes to the point that the platforms create this mediating force about what you create and how you create it, right? And why you create it that way. That is now, I think, an inescapable reality of being a creator. If you do the craft side of the work long enough, you will figure out there are some ways to shape the content. There are some ways to sort of lean things that are just going to resonate. You know that there's ways to shape and frame it that will resonate with actual humans. And you know that there are ways to shape and frame the content that's going to work for the algo and for the platform.
Spend any time in the waters of the creator economy, and you'll learn that some kinds of content do better than others. There are features, fads, and formats that work when others do not. You'll also learn that these features, fads, and formats are not always what makes a message click with humans. Every time we send a piece of media out into the ether, we lean one way or the other. The trouble is that humans may never see something that isn't made for the algorithm. There are some pieces of work that are worth molding into the shape the algorithm's code filters for. However, there is a point at which what the code filters for is irreconcilable with the integrity of that work. I don't think we're there yet across the board, but I do think we're inching in that direction. If I'm playing the game as best I can, given that the rules are hidden and unknowable, but I'm not getting any results, well, that takes a serious toll on my self-efficacy.
And I think in shitification cycle, I think we're at the point with a lot of these platforms where they don't really care about the humans involved at all. Like, the consumers, the creators, none of that really matters. We're at sort of final extraction, maximal extraction point where, you know, it's about advertising, it's about people paying for access, it's about trying to convince people. And I also think one of the things that's happening is, like, there's breakdown about the platforms working. And so I would say, like, let's not assume they know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't.
like, I feel like it's easy to talk about them like there's some sort of, like, effective mastermind plan and we just don't like it. And I actually think it's worse than that.
So what am I willing to do to be heard? To answer this question, we need to not only define the actions we're willing to take, but what it means to be heard in the first place and what it is we want others to hear. Many of us take for granted that social media or even online marketing generally is the only way to spread a message today. And we take for granted that getting a message to spread on Instagram or TikTok is akin to people hearing it. But each of these variables needs to be defined independently to determine a course of action. And once we've come up with a course of action, we must critically assess whether our goals are actually being met or whether we've just succumbed to value capture. Next question, what do we expect from platforms in return for our labor? At least in my corner of the internet, people are more aware that they provide free labor to platforms than they were a few years ago. And that's good. Yet, I don't think enough of us are asking ourselves what we're really getting in return for that free labor. In capitalism, workers trade their time and capacity for work, that is, labor power, for a wage. Even when that exchange is grossly unfair, it's an exchange acknowledged and ostensibly agreed to by both sides. In feudalism, workers provided labor, agricultural production, and crops to feudal lords in exchange for land use rights and military protection. Again, this exchange was grossly unfair in practice, but the exchange was still acknowledged as such. Despite their techno-feudal structure,
you're like, here's my wheat tithe.
Most platforms offer no such exchange. The work we create, upload, and share is done entirely on spec. Now, Substack is a really interesting example because I can actually put numbers to what I'm getting. I have some imperfect analytics, some revenue figures, and a year's worth of data to take a look at.
There's what we will call the Substack tax of 10% of every dollar that we earn, right? On top of the Stripe tax of 3%, right? That goes through that. So, you know, if you boast your favorite Substack or a dollar, right? Out the jump, they're only making 87 cents. And you're like, okay, so it takes money to make money. There's taxes on top of all of this. But at a certain point, you know, what more people are asking, and to be clear, it sounds like we're hypercritical of Substack. Like, we are just doing the thing of, like, thinking things clearly. There's, at a certain point, enough people are going to be like, what am I getting for that 10%? What am I getting for that 10 cents a dollar?
With Substack, the thinking goes that 10% buys us the email delivery system, the website, and new subscribers through Substack's recommendation engine. Now, I know what an email delivery system costs, and I know what a website costs. So if I subtract those expenses from the 10% of each paying subscriber that goes to Substack, I can get an idea of what those new subscribers are costing me. Is it worth it? I'm not sure. The attribution information isn't precise enough for me to really figure it out. But Casey Newton, a tech journalist who founded the Platformer newsletter in 2020, recently explained the relative value of Substack's recommendations to Nilay Patel of The Verge.
I've heard from so many people in the aftermath of all of this saying, Casey, I want to leave, but the network. I'm like, trust me, go check out the paid conversion that you are getting from all of these folks who are signing up for your newsletter. It's probably not going to be that much. You know, I ran the numbers, which, you know, I never should do because I'm bad at math, but I did run the numbers at the end of 2023. And as far as I can tell, despite adding 76,000 free subscribers to Platformer through this dark pattern on Substack in 2023, we ended up net 200 paid customers on the year. So in other words, we basically stayed flat for the entire year, despite adding 75% to our free subscriber base. So
now, like I said earlier, this isn't about crapping all over Substack, because I can't go and do this same math with Instagram or LinkedIn. Instagram, for instance, claims I have 13,000 followers. But at the same time, I can only reach maybe 1,000 of them at a time. So really, what has that platform given me? And what have I given that platform? And is that trade-off worth it? These are the questions that keep me up at night. Now, Substack is an interesting case of creator math in another way, too. Despite it being built for open distribution via email and the ability to export your list, Substack doesn't play nicely with other systems, at least not yet. There's no API to integrate with. That means that I can't hook up other apps to extend the platform's capabilities and generate more revenue. Right.
And you reach a point when you go pro in this creator thing to where you end up with more money than time, right? and you're like, wait a second, I can't even play some of the other games that I know where I put $25 in here and it turns into 50 followers, right? Or 50 subscribers. You can't play that game. So not only are you paying the tax, the only way out is more labor. Mm-hmm. That's problematic at a certain point. So that's as I've been thinking about things and, you know, looking at the relative difference between my effort on, say, LinkedIn and my effort on Substack, especially as it goes to my Better Team Habits channel. I'm like, wait a second. These subscribers from Substack aren't actually converting into paid subscribers. My own audience is, but I brought mm-hmm. them with me. You don't get to claim that, Substack. I brought them with me. I know those names, right? The Substack community itself, because I'm not catering to writers, that's an important piece, right, is not joining this. So why am I privileging one social media site to another one when I'm looking at my labor and time and cost involved?
There's a tendency to think that creating content and using social media for marketing is just a nice add-on for our businesses. It can't hurt, right? And maybe we'll get something out of it. New customers, more brand awareness, customer research. But creator economics can really fry your brain. Your ideas of success, growth, and effectiveness can be hijacked by a system of incentives and penalties that start to shape not only how you think about marketing, but how you think about your whole business. So on that note, the next question is, how do you want to contribute to your communities? Kate often reminds us that a business is a system for meeting needs, for caring for others and ourselves. Creator economics steers us away from that truth towards something more atomized and individualistic. And that, in turn, steers the way we think about our whole business and how we think about contributing value to our communities.
Charlie, when you made the switch to Substack, it also came with a bunch of business model shifts that you made, right? Like around the community that you all ran and like how you sort of distributed content and what was premium and not. I'm curious about how this has played out against like expectations and sort of impacted the business model at large. Like what thoughts looked like for your company in terms of like business decisions.
Yeah, so part of the switch was because we, you know, had our communities split between four or five different platforms and channels and things like that, and it was getting a bit much. And so having some of your community that pays attention on WordPress and some on Mighty Networks and some in your email list and some in different social medias, at a certain point I was like, yo, like we got... This is confusing for me. And if it's confusing for me, it's got to be confusing for them. And so there were some losses in that I'm now having to think like, I really, really miss autoresponders and welcome sequences.
Same.
I really, really miss post-purchase sequences so that I can actually say, hey, you bought a thing for me. Like, let's talk about how you're going to use it and things like that. But I think there are some of those pieces, Kate, that I'm currently hurting real bad on because, again, between... not having some of those basic features, between being able to put out a post and being like, oh, there were 18 people who are now interested in that thing that I can contact and get more follow-up about, like all of those types of things that I had frankly gotten accustomed to are currently struggling. So I'm 6 months into it. And I'm like, I got to fix that. And I'm going to have to fix it outside of Substack because with the way things are going, they are moving more to being a social media site, which works great for them. And less so for me. And so largely speaking, now granted, some of my own factors with health stuff between Angela, between other things going on, I can say that I haven't put in the part-time or full-time effort to get the results because I don't have that, right? But it is, we're a third as far as I would have hoped to have been by now. But I will say that we have made enough to pay for the switching cost. We might be getting close to breaking even on the team support cost to keep it going. Am I making pretty bank on it? No. Now, I've been doing this for 15 years, right? There's like I had an existing sort of thing that came into it. So that's where I would say if I were just a solo creator just getting started and things like that, I would be incredibly happy with my numbers, right? But I have a creative team. I have all those types of things. And on that front, I'm like, we're going to have to make some shifts to make this work long term.
What you're speaking to is something I think is particularly as pertinent to beginners, like folks that are earlier in their process too, which is the risks of going all in on a platform, mm-hmm. which does not care about how you're running your business, does not care about your values or what you're trying to do. It's going to make decisions based on what platform needs, not what Charlie's business needs. But, you know, the inverse of that is that you have a bunch of different pieces going on and there's more labor involved, sure, but you have more control and sort of risk mediation in terms of, you know, Substack all of a sudden deciding that they're going to put a 500-word limit on their articles and, like, there you go. It's interesting, you know, thinking about sort of if this was going to be your job, the risks of that and sort of aligning particularly a platform that feels really easy, that's giving a lot of quick wins up front. It's a risky, really risky move.
What I would say though, Kate, is if I were a one-person creator business, the creator stuff would be sufficient for, you know, middle-class sort of income for me, right? Is that I have a team that makes that challenging, right? So, you know, and that's part of the, to go back to what we're talking about with what platforms have you start thinking is like, well, if that's the case, maybe I go solo. In the bro capitalist tech world, that's like, cool, you go solo. But for me, I'm like, that's people's jobs though, right? That's people's livelihoods. That's other people. That's food that I'm putting on the table for other people. And so it's not just about me and my choices when it comes to that. And that's an important concern. And to your point, Kate, that's where Substack's not thinking like, oh, is this model going to be viable for people who have creative teams? Or is it just going to be viable for, you know, the 3 out of 100 solos that catch fire that create that sort of scenario going forward? And again, I'm not saying that that's what they're thinking or that they have any machinations, but we have to sort of unpack that. And that's what the gift of doing this for 15 years is.
The talk among creators often has to do with, quote, providing value. And that value can take many forms, from tips to advice to analysis to entertainment. But content is only one form of value, and often an unstable one at that. Charlie contributes to his communities locally and digitally by maintaining a container that allows people to work together toward bigger things. To do that, Charlie has to keep his eye on that objective, even when platforms incentivize him to do otherwise. And that leads us to our next question. What do we want to build together?
I want to kind of bring this in a different direction, which is that except for a very few people, even if you exceed your own expectations and are successful at this, you still don't have a livelihood. So there's that. And then I think the other thing about it that has been really interesting to me is that, so we have all of these individuals hoeing their own row, you know, with their own little plots of land, bringing their wheat to Substack at the end of the season. And I think this is a facet of the vector economy, is that ultimately it undermines solidarity. Like, if we look at this as a class issue, what Substack is building is everybody in their own little tower. There's a lot of individualism. There's a lot of exceptionalism of, like, I'm really trying to differentiate myself, be the best I can be. That's how I'm going to get picked by Substack.
Like Chiara Lohr from the Indie Sellers Guild put it a couple of weeks ago, our challenges on a platform get transformed into personal challenges. The same spirit that energizes the entrepreneurial drive and says, it's up to me, also energizes the internalization of failure and says, it's all my fault.
I think where this actually leads us is further away from any kind of collective success or caretaking or any kind of...
Because platforms don't have to play ball with their huge unpaid workforce. Each worker has to make a decision for themselves about what they're willing to put up with, whether it's Twitter, or Instagram or Substack, the platform will make a choice that hurts creators. Some creators will adapt, others will ignore it, and still others will leave and take their talents elsewhere.
I think the mechanics of how the system works and how platforms work directly undermines attempts at building that solidarity. It's a little bit like Amazon bringing in union busters.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a metaphorical union busting happening. Like we saw it with the whole Nazi mm-hmm. issue. There were some pockets of organization and pushback and stuff happening. And then some of those people that were the most vocal in organizing about it, they just fled. They took their little pieces of land and moved them away. And we're done with this. But I thought that was really interesting to sort of see some percolation of organizing and people actually trying to come together to be what do we want from this platform that is, running our lives where we're spending all of this time, and how quickly it all diffused because the underlying economics and mechanics of the platform ultimately won out.
What if it didn't diffuse quickly? What could we do together to resist the feudal power of platforms? Just off the top of my head, demanding a heads up at least 30 days in advance of a new feature rollout, things like direct messages, follower recommendations, prioritizing video. Well, that would be a start. But beyond that, there are many ways that we can build things together that are completely unrelated to platforms.
Even those people that are winning, they've actually created relational layers outside of the algos and platforms that are making all that work, right? They're texting each other. They are emailing each other. They're co-creating. They're going into joint ventures. Those things happen. And it's that side of the creator economy that I don't think gets talked about enough, partially because it starts to feel like an insider outsider thing, right? And people don't realize wait a second. I can create those relationships with the 5 to 6 people that I want to rock with, and right. we grow together. Right. But that is going against a lot of just white supremacy culture in our society anyways, that we band together to do things versus we're the heroes that win. Yeah.
Unfortunately, to Kate's earlier point, banding together in a small group can really feel like playing small when platforms espouse the potential to reach millions.
And so, not to be an apologist for the platform folks, they have to market in ways that people will buy and be interested in, right? And when you have a cultural substrata that valorizes the lone wolf and the single hero and the you're the important star and everyone else, when you have that at the bottom, it is very hard for them to have a message of or you can come together and 10 of you can make something happen. It just goes, how does that happen? And I know that because part of my book and Start Finishing is teaching people about success packs, and I lay it out, and I will still have people who after reading is but I don't understand how to make this happen. I'm like, I just told you how to make this happen. But that is a skill that a lot of people in our society do not have and do not want to build, right? Because at the end of the day, it feels easier just to do shit by yourself.
And it's easier for platforms to extract from us if Correct. We're atomized as individuals.
Correct. It is, in fact, easier. And so that's where I just want to say there is a cultural behavior that would exist outside of platforms.
Yes, yes.
And platforms are pulling out those pieces and marketing the messages that exacerbate the very things that we're concerned about here.
And so that leads us to the final question. How will we organize?
Oh, we have to develop off-platform relationships and packs and cabals. That's the way it's always worked, and it's going to be more important, yep. That we go that route.
Management researchers Catherine Kellogg, Melissa Valentine, and Angel Kristen looked into algorithmic management as a new mechanism of control for employers. But they noticed that workers were individually and collectively resisting algorithmic control through a set of emerging tactics they called algo-activism. Their observations of algo-activism included tactics that fell into 4 buckets. 1, practical action. 2, worker organizing. 3, messaging. And 4, legal mobilization. One way of taking practical action is what Kate pointed out in our earlier conversation about the creator economy. Feeding the algo with content that's designed to send all the right data signals while acting as a vehicle for a more subversive message. Another is exploiting new features, which platforms prioritize in terms of distribution, to spread a message or aesthetic that's typically not amplified by algorithmic distribution. Other forms of algo activism include forming creative cooperatives, putting pressure on lawmakers, and taking direct action against corporations.
What I'm seeing is pockets of folks being more clear about what they're building apart from what platforms want from them. And like that for the algo posts is in some way, I think that's like a reclamation of, yeah, I'm going to do this thing because I have to, but then let's go have the real conversation that I want to have. And so I do think folks are getting smarter and more clear about how platforms and the places where their work is being distributed don't serve them. And I think are going to get savvy about having those conversations about how to work around. And my hope is that that leads to let's ditch these platform overlords and find our own distribution channels. And like, I think things like the Flaming Hydra publication, like where folks are coming together and creating their own kind of cooperative distribution channels and magazines where multiple folks are plugging in. I hope to see more of those where folks have editing accountability, they have people to bounce ideas off of, they have solidarity in terms of the economics of what they're building and things like that. You know, we're smarter about how all these platforms aren't really serving our interests at the end of the day. And I hope that that builds to something outside of the platforms.
Platforms aren't the solution to our creative work woes. They're tools. Platforms won't ever be the solution because the solution is people. People working together to care for each other and leverage the power they have as a group. At the very top, I mentioned that philosopher Rahel Yagi's theory of alienation is bound up in the question, how do I want to live? The state of alienation, that is disconnection and meaninglessness, both prevents us from answering that question and prevents us from even asking it. Yagi's theory of alienation accepts that we become alienated through our interaction with alienating systems. Systems such as capitalistic labor relations. We might not be able to avoid that, but, she argues, we can choose to interact with those systems differently. One way to resist alienation, to reconnect, to find new meaning, is to see our fellow creative workers as allies in the struggle for the lives we want to live. Choosing to see a problem and asking how we can solve it with others is another. So, is that how you want to live? Huge thanks to Charlie Gilkey, author of Team Habits and Start Finishing, and the co-founder of Productive Flourishing. You can find him at productiveflourishing.com. And huge thanks to Kate Tyson, the only artist I know who runs a bookkeeping and consulting agency. You can find that agency at wonderwellconsulting.com and her writing at katetyson.substack.com. You can also find her podcast, Whiskey Fridays, wherever you listen to What Works. What Works is a production of Yellow House Media, a podcast production agency for people changing the way we think about culture, creativity, leadership, and work. Our production coordinator is Lou Blazer. Our production assistant is Emily Kilduff. This episode was written and edited by me, Tara McMullen. Marty Seafelt is our audio engineer, and Sean McMullen is our fearless leader and executive producer. What Works is produced on stolen land. We're grateful to the Susquehannock and Conestoga peoples who stewarded this land for thousands of years before the arrival of white colonists. The Yellow House is on the unceded land of the Kutanaha Nation and the tribes of the Salish and Kalispell.